And our very special reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, joining us, earthfiles.com. Up next, my oh my, what is this strange sound they are hearing in Wisconsin and all over this planet? But we're going to key in on Clintonville when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, we have reporter Terry Leon from our affiliate in Green Bay, Wisconsin. He's been reporting on this situation. Mm-hmm. And people are just baffled out there. What have you uncovered?
Well, I have been doing reports about loud booms and other unexplained sounds at my news website, earthfiles.com, for at least the past 2 years. But like the other strange sounds heard around the world the past year, reports became more numerous, and the descriptions of boom sounds are now more intense since January of 2012 to this day. For example, since February, I have received loud jolting boom reports from 15 locations ranging from Ontario, Canada, Virginia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Oregon, Connecticut, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Minnesota, Washington State, Louisiana, Maine, Kansas, and even Lithuania this week. Now, between March 6th and March 18th, there were loud booms that shook five counties in southeastern Georgia and shook two counties in central Alabama. And then, beginning March 18th, were the persistent, loud, jolting booms in Clintonville, Wisconsin that made national news. On March 20th, I interviewed the city administrator of Clintonville, Wisconsin, Lisa Kuss. In great detail, she summarized all the city efforts to find an answer to the jolts that she herself had experienced twice, and she stressed that geologists and seismologists dismiss seismic activity as an explanation because seismic activity is usually 3 miles deep and would not explain the close-up, jolting, rattling booms that so many people were reporting in Clintonville and even 80 miles southwest in Montello, Wisconsin, on March 20th, the same day that I was interviewing the Clintonville city administrator. Now, after police dispatchers received a few more calls early Thursday morning, March 22nd, Clintonville City Administrator Lisa Kuss announced that she was hiring the engineering firm of Rueckert & Mielke of Waukesha, Wisconsin, to install four ground seismology monitors around the city to find any possible epicenter underground that could be responsible for the persistent booms. Lisa Kuss plans to spend up to $7,000, she said, on the seismology monitoring investigation. Then, strangely, at a Tuesday evening, March 22nd public meeting at the Clintonville High School, after hiring the engineering firm to locate the underground epicenter of the strange jolting sounds, Lisa Kuss told the crowd of 400 people that she was now pretty certain the sounds had to be related to earthquakes because on Tuesday, March 20th, 2 days earlier, at 12:15 a.m., 30 miles northwest of Appleton, Wisconsin, which is near Clintonville, at a depth of 3 miles, there was a small 1.5 quake registered by the U.S. Geological Survey. However, most of the Clintonville residents at the meeting argued that they had never heard jolting booms before Sunday night, March 18th. Further, seismologists said there was no seismic link to the banging noises from March 18th to the 22nd, no seismic activity in the Montello region either, and that earthquake activity usually does happen 3 miles down, as that 1.5 mm-hmm. did, and it was very small. And people, including Lisa Kuss, had the jolt of their life, their bodies shaking, the ground shaking. It had to be shallow, according to seismic geologists. 6 days later, after the public meeting with the strange explanation laid on the back of that little 1.5 earthquake, the police in Clintonville began receiving some 65 calls again, reporting three or four more very loud booms. So the announcement politically didn't stop the phenomena. And one of the Clintonville residents reported, quote, "I just heard the loudest boom tonight, Tuesday, March 27th at 10:24 p.m. Scared me to death. It sounded like a truck hit my house." And many people in all of these different states have described metallic sounds and compare them to cars or trains crashing outside of their home. The week before, on March 20th, when I interviewed Lisa Coos, and there were no answers to the loud booms, she started with what happened after midnight, early Monday morning, when she first came into it. The calls had started that night on March 18th, but as the clock went past midnight, they really started getting calls, and she went out to join with her city authorities. And now we know that the sound has continued since March 18th, and here now is Clintonville City Administrator Lisa Coos, 1 week ago, with information that is as relevant now as it was then.
At 1:45, crews were called in, first because of the popping-type noise. We investigated our electrical substation that's in that area. There was nothing out of the ordinary at that location. Then we started to next look internally to our water and sewer system, and were able to have our local gas company, We Energies, and an ANR pipeline representative, along with city officials, to monitor any gas levels that could have been elevated because people were talking about it sounding explosive.
Could you elaborate about popping sound at 1:45 a.m. on Monday, March 19th?
People describe it as something exploded. People thought that things happened in their basement. They sound like a loud popping, an explosive type bang noise, or a series of bang, bang, bang. So because it wasn't as public at that time, nobody really knew that other people were experiencing it. People first reacted, did something happen in my basement? Did a vehicle hit my house? Did a tree fall on my house? Am I hearing thunder? Similar to those kinds of noises where it's a heavy, jolting, and jarring, banging noise and feeling for those that actually felt it. Some only heard it and did not feel it.
And for those first crews then out after the 1:45 a.m. reports of popping and exploding, what happened? Did the crews stay out or did they return to offices and then you started getting a flood of more phone calls at 5:30?
No, we stayed out all night. So my police, fire, public works, and utility employees were all out together. And we created teams of people, so that police, fire, and utility with gas monitoring equipment. And we walked from one end of a street that was reporting lots of activity all the way to the other end. So it may have been an 8-block walk. And they just dropped the monitor into each manhole and detected absolutely no elevated gas levels. And it seemed like the most intense times were from 2 to 3 a.m. And so we stayed out, continued to monitor. I know myself, I was out in the neighborhood at 8:45 a.m. that morning, and there was definitely a jolt that occurred at that time.
Could you describe it in more detail because it's your personal experience?
Both of the times that I experienced it, one was that morning and one was at 10 minutes to 10 last evening. It is clearly a banging, one instantaneous bang. In one case, I was standing on a cement sidewalk, and in another, I was standing in a large utility building. Clearly, it jolts you. It sounds like someone dropped a piece of dynamite outside of the building that you're in, or that like something sort of exploded under the ground, but it's just one large bang, and you feel it, and it's over.
What did you feel physically?
Just the fact that the earth shook. I guess I would describe it as if you were next to some sort of a construction site and a wrecking ball just did one bang into a building or one jackhammer banging into the ground, that earthy type jolt, not a continuous vibration, just one solid jolt.
But you had the sense that it was below your feet, below the floor?
Clearly on the cement sidewalk, it was underneath. You know, it sounded like the exploding noise, that bang, came from underneath the earth's surface. And when we were in the building, you would have thought that something happened immediately outside the building, but you feel it in your feet. Some people report feeling things rattling. People's lamps rattled on their tables, that their windows and doors shook.
Any sense of what it might have been?
You have absolutely no clue. That's the frustrating thing, and that you know that what you heard and felt is what everybody else feels at that exact moment. We had absolutely no phone calls late afternoon yesterday or into the early evening. And as soon as we felt the jolt at 8:10 p.m. yesterday, the phone lines lit up at the police department for the following 15 minutes, and then they stopped. So you know that everybody's experiencing the exact same jolt of energy.
Okay, so that was 8:10 p.m. on Monday evening, March 19th.
There was another large jolt at 10 p.m., and then again at 12 a.m., 1 a.m., and 2 a.m. And when we indicate that those are the times, it's based on a large volume of phone calls coming in immediately after that time to the police department.
Did the descriptions change at all?
The only thing that changed was a somewhat wider area of people calling. And so the descriptions of what was happening was not different. However, where we had sort of quantified it to the northeast quadrant of the city, it seemed to go slightly further west and south of that same quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not leave the northeast quadrant. So it got bigger. It didn't shift to a different area. We have spoken to geologists both at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to explain the things that have happened. And we have confirmed via the seismology monitors that are about 30 minutes away is the closest one. There's no earthquake being monitored near us. They also have looked at other geological things like earth shifting, what they call ice or frost quakes. We have spoken to our county and all the counties around us regarding mining, explosive permits, any sort of mining going on in pits or anything like that where there could be man-made activity going on around us that would cause these noises to occur, and we've confirmed that that's not the case. We've spoken to the Department of Military and confirmed, although we do have a National Guard armory, that nothing has occurred there in and around our area with any planes, ammunition, anything like that. We have spoken to other engineers that have looked at the bedrock in our area, and it doesn't sound consistent with anything that they know. We've spoken to our large industries in the community to see if anything's changed over the last few days or last week or so that would be different in their operations that could be creating any of this jolting type behavior somewhere around the earth.
Have you talked with anyone about whether or not there might be some unidentified caverns or tunnels or anything underneath the area of Clintonville?
One of our local industries has a tunnel between two of their buildings. We toured that tunnel and were able to monitor the gas levels in there, which again came up with nothing. We also have discussed caverns. There's nothing that we are aware of that would be the thing that is occurring.
And where you were standing, once on the sidewalk and once on a floor, are you aware of any sort of underground cavern, chamber, basement, anything underneath where you were standing yourself?
No, I was just standing on a regular sidewalk adjacent to a public street. Based on the geologists, I have reason to believe that it's got to be within the first mile under the Earth's surface. Earthquakes typically occur further down than a mile, and that is what is clearly not being registered on any earthquake monitoring devices. So if there is anything going on, it has to be within the first mile underneath the ground.
And so far, from military to engineers to seismologists to all the utility experts, mining people, no one knows of anything that is within a mile underground of the surface of Clintonville.
Nothing that would lead anyone to believe that they can explain what's been going on and why it's been happening.
As a city administrator for nearly 15 years, what is your reaction when you realize that you don't have an answer?
Based on the fact that we've spent researching as much as we have, It seems to be that the most logical conclusion is that it is some sort of natural phenomena that's occurring under the Earth's surface, and could something be shifting because of that? And we may never really have a definitive answer what has happened.
Is there any possibility that the United States military could have underground facilities that they do not have permission to declassify, and that when they say that they don't know of anything, could it possibly be underground military installations?
I suppose anything is possible, but I would have a hard time believing that they wouldn't, to some degree, be honest about what could be occurring.
And George, I was surprised to learn that Lisa Coos, at that interview, did not know anything about the similar loud jolting booms in Georgia and Alabama that have been happening in the week and a half right before Clintonville.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
She did not know loud booms have been reported north of her in Canada, like this February report from Mark Dale, Ontario, quote, "I live out in the boonies about 2 hours northwest of Toronto, Canada, in Markdale. In February, in the middle of the day, I experienced such a noise as you have been reporting about in Clintonville, Wisconsin. I was in one building on our property when I heard what sounded like a progressive collapse of some sort, as if a large tree had crashed into our barn, knocking it down and then knocking down steel racking within, throwing the contents of various machinery onto the cement floor. A very violent event, to be sure. I, with much dread, headed out to see what had happened, especially since we had no insurance. I could find absolutely nothing amiss in any of our buildings or our house, and no big tree came down, nothing, again implying the sound of metallic crashing. And then, only 3 days before Clintonville, Wisconsin, on March 18th, that night, on March 15th, in the morning, around 8:28. This is a quote from an email from a Brunswick, Georgia resident. This morning at around 8:28 a.m., a large explosion or boom was heard over Brunswick. This boom shook window and doors throughout the entire county. Upon further reports, it was felt from as far west as 10 miles west of Waycross, Georgia, south to Folkston, Georgia, and north to Savannah, Georgia. A local radio call show took calls from people that heard and felt this large event, and this is the one that was felt over five counties when all of the authorities got their notes together and compared five counties at the same time within 15 minutes. They had hundreds and hundreds of calls from people reporting, as this person did in Brunswick, Georgia. And then in Virginia Beach, Virginia, quote, "Early Saturday morning on March 17th, 2012 at 5:42 a.m., I was awakened by a single, very intense explosion. The concussion shook the building and was not accompanied by any other sound, just one explosion that came from out of nowhere and then silence. It was an ear-splitting sound, or to be more precise, a simultaneous heavy earth and sky splitting sound. I got up and wrote the time down, 5:42 a.m. I didn't make a 911 call or 911 call, but would have if the sound persisted. And I have asked many people about that. People are being jolted, like Lisa Coos said she was really jolted below her feet, her entire body. People are reporting their bones rattling, their windows rattling, their walls.
It's one of the most incredible stories, Linda. I'm glad you're on it. Don't let it go. We'll be back with more. Well, get your phone calls ready. Next hour, we'll have conversations with Linda, questions for her, maybe even stories from you that you might be an insider. We'll be back in a moment as we continue now with the situation at Fukushima. It just doesn't go away. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. It's been more than a year now since the horrible tragedy in Japan with the tsunami and earthquake that hit its nuke plant and killed so many thousands of people. Linda, what's the latest there?
Well, unfortunately, the Japanese government was not forthcoming then, and they have not been forthcoming now. And on March 29th, just yesterday before this live program, the New York Times reported under a headline, quote, Japan admits nuclear plant still poses dangers, close quote, and that the damage, quote, to the core for at least one of the meltdown-stricken reactors at Fukushima could be far worse than previously thought, raising fresh concerns over the plant's stability and gravely complicating the post-disaster cleanup, close quote. The source is an internal investigation released this week by the Tokyo Electric Power Plant operator known as TEPCO. They are the managers of the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The TEPCO investigation has revealed that the unit number 2 reactor barely has water in the containment vessel that holds the radioactive fuel rods. Unit 2 has only 2 feet of water instead of the 33 feet it is supposed to have to keep the fuel rods stable. George, this is now, a year later, and this is critical. Sure. Even today, at the end of March 2012, TEPCO workers are still pumping about 9 tons of water every hour into Unit 2's core to keep it cool. But the containment vessel radiation has been measured at 72 sieverts. That's enough radiation to kill a person in minutes and to cause electrical equipment to malfunction. So now, special equipment might need to be developed that can tolerate the still high radiation levels. The low water level plus high radiation in Unit 2 means that radioactive water might be leaking out at an even higher rate than previously estimated, flowing through pipes and right into the Pacific Ocean. The New York Times analysis of the TEPCO report indicates that damaged reactors 1 and 3, quote, could be in even worse condition. Hydrogen explosions blew out the outer walls of those reactors, and officials believe that more nuclear fuel has breached the containment vessel at the number 1 reactor than even Units 2, 3, and 4, close quote. Even at Unit 4, that suffered a hydrogen explosion early on, the spent fuel rods now lie unprotected outside the unit's containment vessel. On top of all of these problems, the Japanese government made a decision at the end of 2011 to burn the tons of radioactive waste from now in 2012 through 2014, defending its plan to mix radioactive debris with non-radioactive debris that will dilute the amount of radioactive contamination to safe levels, says the government. But nuclear engineer and nuclear safety expert Arne Gunderson at Fairwinds Associates in Burlington, Vermont, told me on March 16th, before the release of the inside TEPCO investigation was made public, that he completely disagrees with the burning radioactive debris project and sees a still possible nightmare situation if there is another earthquake and further damage to the Fukushima nuclear reactors. Here now is Arne Gunderson.
There was a school near Tokyo that had a very contaminated tarp that was laid out on the field back in March. And they rolled the tarp up and somebody discovered, oh my God, this thing is really contaminated. Rather than treat that tarp as radioactive waste, a couple thousand pounds, what they're doing is they're adding to it 1,000 times more clean waste. So they're diluting down the amount of radiation per pound. Of course, they've created 1,000 times more volume in the process. So they're burning this tarp with 1,000 times more clean waste. And then they're taking that ash and they're saying it's acceptable to throw into Tokyo Bay because the concentrations are so low. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's absurd. The better way of doing it, take that tarp and treat that tarp as radioactive waste and put it in a geologic form where it's locked up somewhere, not lying in Tokyo Bay. So I think they have deluded themselves into thinking if they spread the radioactivity out, nobody will notice. And it just is not true. What's already happening is it's concentrating in the bottoms of rivers. You're seeing it already starting to work its way up through the food chain. We've got a highly radioactive rabbit that was caught 100 kilometers, 60 miles away from Fukushima. The rabbits are already radioactive. We've got cedar pollen. Now, it's almost spring in Fukushima Prefecture, and the cedar trees are budding, and they're loaded with cesium. So the cesium is going to revolatilize and go airborne again because the cedar pollen is going to carry it as much as 100 miles. The Japanese are fooling themselves when they look at this problem and think that by spreading it out all over their whole population, it's going to go away.
And what are the implications for us in the United States and the rest of the world if radioactivity continues to be burned from now until 2014 from Japan?
There was a scientific study recently that said 20% of the radiation from Fukushima wound up on Japan. 78% wound up in the Pacific Ocean. So first off, thank God the wind was blowing out to sea because the country of Japan would no longer be able to function if the wind had been blowing across. It would have cut Japan in half. But 78% of the nuclear waste from Fukushima is now in the ocean. So that'll work its way up through the food chain over time. And I think you'll see top of the food chain predators like tuna and salmon, barracuda, things like that, showing high concentrations in a couple of years. So where'd the other 2% go? Most of it went into the Cascade Range of the United States. We found measurable concentrations of cesium in the Portland area, measurable concentrations in the Vancouver area. We know there were hot particles in the air in Seattle in April. So clearly people have been exposed. Because the radiation is dispersed up and down the coast, we're never going to find the person who got the Fukushima radiation. But there will be additional cancers, especially in the Cascades, because most of what didn't fall in Japan and most of what didn't fall in the Pacific wound up in the Cascade Range.
The Cascade Range you would define as British Columbia, Canada, Oregon, Washington, and perhaps some of California?
Yeah. I actually had a lab report from a person in California who sampled pine cones, and they found both radioactive cesium-134 and 137 in pine cones in California. Now, nowhere near the concentrations that we see in Japan, but any amount of radiation can cause a cancer. I'm anticipating about 1 million cancers in Japan for the next 20 or 30 years as a result of the Fukushima accident.
And burning radioactive debris has not been defined as illegal in any international law?
No.
Back in Japan, is there any objective agency that is monitoring the burning of the radioactive debris to see if the radiation is rising toward any dangerous levels?
I think the concentrations they're already experiencing are dangerous. What the Japanese are considering safe, even when they dilute it 1,000 times to 1, in the United States, that material would be subject to being treated as radioactive waste and being dumped in a monitored retrievable situation in Texas, for instance. So what the Japanese are spreading throughout the country in the United States would already be considered radioactive waste. I was in Tokyo 3 weeks ago, and I just took 5 samples. I wasn't cherry picking. I wasn't looking for any hot spots. I just stopped and peeled up the dirt by a children's playground that had been decontaminated. I peeled up the dirt in a crack in the pavement. I was up on a rooftop garden, and I took the dirt from the rooftop garden and declared them back through customs and said, doing a scientific study, I've got a little bit of dirt here, and they allowed me through. And all of them were over 7,000 disintegrations every second in a kilogram of soil. All of those samples would be considered radioactive waste here in the United States. And in Tokyo, people are just walking by it every day and don't even know it's there. So, no, the Japanese solution is to raise the standard so high that the standard is effectively meaningless.
Which is a form of Alice in Wonderland denial.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. The Japanese government is in denial.
What is the current knowledge that you have about temperatures rising in Unit 2 and what happened to the plutonium? There was more in Unit 3.
When you shut a nuclear reactor down, you really don't stop the heat that's coming out of it. The chain reaction stops, but all of the pieces of uranium that have been broken off fission products remain hot for 5 years, physically hot. They remain radioactive for hundreds of years, but they remain physically hot for 5 years or more. So we're going to continue to see heat coming out of these power plants for 5 years, which is why the Japanese have to throw water in. The temperature increases in Unit 2 appear to be a faulty instrument, and I sort of believe that. The biggest problem that I see is the seismic risk, because we've got fuel pools in Units 4 and 3 and 2 and 1 that are exposed to the atmosphere now. And if there's a major seismic event, especially in Units 3 and 4, if those fuel pools crack, we can still be right back to where we were on the very first day of the accident and risk destroying the nation of Japan. The Brookhaven National Labs did a study that showed that if a fuel pool were to lose its water, it would cause a fuel pool fire, and that would volatilize lots of nasty radioactive chemicals that could kill 186,000 people relatively quickly from cancer. So the big problem is the fuel pools on Units 3 and 4, because those are the ones that are structurally the most compromised. Should there be another seismic event, they may not withstand it. So that's my big concern looking forward, is let's just pray that they don't have another big earthquake. I think it's Tokyo Electric's top priority to empty the fuel pool in Unit 4. Now, the fuel pool in Unit 3 is just as bad, but Unit 3 is so radioactive that no one's ever gotten near it yet. We essentially have two fuel pools, that either one of which could cause another mass evacuation.
And Unit 3 is where there was more plutonium in that MOX fuel, correct?
There was 30 bundles of MOX fuel in Unit 3. There's a lot of plutonium in Unit 3 anyway. All of the reactors had plutonium because it's a byproduct of a 238 absorbing a neutron, and they all had been running for years. So I don't think the little bit of extra MOX fuel in Unit 3 was a causative factor in any of the extra problems in Unit 3.
There really were three meltdowns, and it's the meltdowns into the nuclear core that we are now wrestling with all of these huge radioactive problems.
Yes, that's correct. The meltdowns are because nuclear cores have been running for 4 years, and there was an enormous amount of radioactive decay products. When I was over in Japan, I said, all of the people on the planet have a deep debt to the 1,000 or 2,000 men who risked their lives on not just Fukushima Daiichi, but Fukushima Daini, which almost melted down. So there's about 1,000 or 2,000 people who definitely saved Japan and who likely saved the world from a real serious accident, because they risked their lives in the first 2 or 3 weeks. While the Japanese government was saying there's no problem, TEPCO was downplaying the significance. A couple thousand people risked their lives and reduced their life expectancy, for sure, to save all of us.
A year ago, when we first did the interview after March 11th, 2011, you said that this had the potential to be greater than Chernobyl. What do you think today?
Well, there's three different kinds of gases that were released. The noble gases are definitely worse than Chernobyl. Scientific papers out that show that this was three times worse than Chernobyl as far as releases of noble gases. The other is radioactive iodine and radioactive cesium. It's a numbers game because nobody measured this stuff. There were no detectors working. They all lost their power and they all got blown to smithereens. So the nuclear industry is trying to push the numbers to show that it's less than Chernobyl. When I do the numbers, it says bad or worse than Chernobyl. But Chernobyl was awful, and we're comparing degrees of awfulness. And I think that the noble gas data shows that it was three times worse than Chernobyl. And we're not out of the woods yet. If there's an earthquake, we're right back to the very first week.
And with all this seismic activity that we have been having around the planet, the idea that if there is another 7.5, 8, something that could end up cracking even more Fukushima, we really could be back to 311 and radioactivity that would be making the evacuation zone so much larger, and already it is a dead zone there that will be there for the foreseeable future. And here are a few more updates on Japan's radioactivity issues. Radioactive cesium has been found in Pacific Ocean plankton nearly 375 miles away from the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster. And the expectation now is that plankton-eating fish will become contaminated as well with radioactive cesium. The Environment Ministry announced that radioactive cesium levels have soared to 154,000 becquerels per kilogram in soil around the Fukushima prefecture village of Yatate, now deserted except for some animals that will die. The future of Japan's population around the Fukushima region and beyond can be seen in a reanalysis of cancer incidents near Three Mile Island nuclear plant of March 28, 1979 in the United States. Originally, the nuclear industry and government reports in the United States concluded that the maximum gamma dose to a member of the general population was only about 1 microsievert, and that the Three Mile Island meltdown would not result in detectable health effects. But Dr. Steve Wing and colleagues reanalyzed data from the TMI Public Health Fund, and the result is, quote, increases in cancer incidence after the 1979 TMI incident were greater in areas estimated to have been more exposed to the accident plumes. These associations were stronger, in particular, in all cancers and leukemia. Findings support the allegation that people in the area who reported skin redness, hair loss, vomiting, and pet deaths at the time of the 1979 Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown were not suffering from emotional stress, but rather were exposed to high-level radiation, close quote. And right now, Arnie Gunderson is saying that in several measurements, he still insists Fukushima is worse than Chernobyl.
What an unbelievable story, Linda.
Yeah.
And the denial is just even strangely more unbelievable.
Well, and why? Why does that government, over an entire year, consider to make pronouncements and announcements that nobody now believes by any stretch? And I just recently got an email from that professor. Remember, I did it was in the fall, having to do with a professor from Missouri who had a wife and kids.
Right. They were out there.
Had been making his own measurements 300 and some miles from Fukushima and finding the soil in his backyard, in the school ground, all of it was too high. And he sent me an email, and he and his family are now in New Zealand.
And they should be.
Well, they are the first of probably so many who are going to choose to leave Japan. Would it have made a difference if the government had responded with reality from the beginning?
Up next, we're going to have conversations with Linda Moulton Howe, giving you the opportunity to chat with her. Or if you're a whistleblower and you've got a story you want her to chase down, why don't you share it with us? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.